Thank you for the invitation. So I have to apologize for the clumsy title, but I didn't know quite what to talk about today. Since I'm local, I thought I would just sort of give some overview of what we do in the lab, just because hopefully somebody here might be interested in what we do. Okay? All right. So I wanted to motivate this idea that one can study sort of these whole organisms, right? In a systems level, at a systems level, to investigate how biochemical networks or neuronal networks that underlie control the behavior of these organisms might reveal some sort of universal characteristics, right? So there might be some simplicity, right, in how these function, even though that they might be complicated at some level. So these networks, they perform some computation. They take in some environmental measurements, say chemical concentration or the temperature in the environment. They encode this measurement and they produce some output that has some adaptive value to these organisms. So many people measure things like gene expression, but when I talk about the output of these systems, I'm talking about locomotion, behavior. So I wanted to motivate this talk by showing you a system that we really know very well, that's almost completely described at this network level, this protein level, and where the measure of behavior is very simple, because it's, in fact, basically one-dimensional, right? And then contrast that with this neuronal network that comes from C. elegans, a worm, animal, an organism that's more complicated. Right, and it has more difficulties when you try to quantify behavior. Okay. So this is C. elegans. This is E. coli. This E. coli is swimming around. Right. So it's a single cell. The scale is about a micron. It swims. It measures some thermal stimulus and produces changes in its motor behavior. So it can do something useful. For example, it can measure temperature. If I put these bacteria on a linear gradient of temperature, they will aggregate at a specific temperature. They'll do thermotaxis to that temperature. So somehow this is likely useful to the organism. Basically, we want to understand, how does it do this? How does it transform thermal signals into behavior that allows it to do this? So to do that, we take a different sort of attack than most people. We look at the systems level response. Say I look at the response function of the system to an impulse of temperature, right? And using this impulse response, basically this is useful because you can reconstruct, assuming the system's linear, any arbitrary response to an arbitrary input with the impulse response. And we'll use this to actually understand how it responds to thermal signals, and also to do something like measure the thermal preference, this thermal memory, right? Okay, so the first understand how to do this, we have to think about what the output is. And the output, I'll argue, in bacteria is very simple. It swims because there's helical rotary motors that are the base of these helical flagella. These flagella act as propellers, and when these motors are spinning, they allow the cell to move. Okay? So this motor is well understood. And basically, this motor can spin in two directions. It can go clockwise or counterclockwise. And the behavior of the bacteria depends on the direction that this motor is spinning. Keep it simple. So if I look and try to understand how this bacteria swims, but when presented with some information, say a diffusive signal of attractant from this pipette, somehow this bacteria will measure this gradient, and it will aggregate around the high point of this attractant. So what does it do? You could parameterize this motion to basically being two states, a run and tumble state. The bacteria runs and then reorients itself randomly, and this acts like a random walk, and it looks diffusive. But what happens is when the bacteria is making a measurement in time of the chemical concentration, if this chemical concentration is an attractant, and it's increasing in time, what it does, it suppresses the probability to make a tumble, to do this reorientation. So on average, it will diffuse up the gradient. Okay. So if we wanted to quantify this as an experimentalist, this is quite messy to do. So we've developed another technique where we take bacteria and we pin them down by single motors. So if you look at sort of these time-lapse movies of how bacteria are swimming, this run and tumble state is dependent on the direction of these single motors. I won't get into it more than that, but just let's say that this is a proxy of this behavior, and this behavior dictates the macroscopic motions of the bacteria. So I want to quantify the statistics of this response, because it's the statistics that control the macroscopic motions. Yeah? Okay, they're rotating fast at some level. Actually, they're not rotating very fast.
Well, the left one is rotating much
faster than the right. Oh, between here and this one. Okay, so it's the load on the motor. So effectively, this is a smaller bacteria, possibly, than this one. It just depends on the viscous drag. Okay, so I will quickly skip this because I can't explain this one. But the idea is that we don't care about the speed. Because it's only the direction that is really important here, because it's the direction that changes this, okay? So to do this, I simply measure the speed, the angular velocity, and I can measure the direction that this is spinning. And what we want to do is we want to just characterize the probability of this thing being in the run state or the tumble state, all right? So how do we do this experiment if we want to look at the thermotaxis network? Before I go into that, I just want to mention some things why people might want to study this temperature response. This system is well described for chemotaxis. Thermotaxis utilizes this network. So all the theoretical tools, experimental results that people have done on chemotaxis can be utilized for thermotaxis. Almost every organism measures temperature, right? And works robustly in a range of temperatures. We feel like this is a nice network to study this. There's different challenges in this network because, in principle, I can change the concentration of chemicals on the outside and not affect the network. But when I change the temperature, all the rates of these enzymes, in principle, will change, but yet still function. So basically, we want to understand how this thermal memory is read out of this network, right, as a function of temperature. And after we do this and understand this, this is a nice network to understand how maybe integrations of different signals, chemical and temperature, cross-talk and allow the organism to do more than just sort of a single function. Okay, I just wanted to mention that all the proteins of the network have been identified. All the rates have been estimated and measured. This network is well studied, well known for the ability to adapt to a range of chemical concentration. I just want to mention here that, you know, as the chemical concentration or the temperature changes, what happens is that there's a signaling aspect where it affects the statistics of the motor, but there's an adaptation aspect, a feedback loop, that affects the sensitivity of the receptors, of the sensors, to that actual input. So this allows an adaptation of the sensitivity of the network to always match the concentration of the signal or the amplitude of the signal. But the time scales are different here. This is fast, the actual activation or change of the motor versus the resetting of the sensitivity of the receptor. And this actually allows the system to have a short-term memory. The past conditions are encoded in the slow loop, while the present conditions are activated in this fast pathway, okay? Just to preface some results that I'll show you in a second. So basically what I want to do now is measure this response function. And I want to do it quantitatively using this motor assay where we tether single motors to a cover slip. To do this, we impulse the system with a little blip of heat. We do this by basically an optical trap, where the trap is not really trapping the bacteria, but it's just heating the bacteria, because I'm using an IR laser. I blip the heat, the tau of cooling is on order of 100 milliseconds, and we just look at the response after we blip the bacteria with a little bit of heat. We align the motor response. We only care about the directionality, so we binarize this response. They're aligned by this impulse of heat, and now we get the probability of the response of the motor being in the run direction or the tumble direction, and we get the impulse response. So after looking at many bacteria, zapping them many times, what we can do now is get this response function. And this response function, right, if you look at this, tells us the computation. If I look at, say, individual bacteria, the response function varies quite widely, but the average gives us this biphasic response. This tells us it's taking a derivative. It's positively weighting the input in the near past, say a couple seconds, and then subtracting off a weighted response for, say, further in the past, say 4 or 5 seconds. So with this kernel, we know that the computation is happening on order of about 7 seconds. It's taking a derivative, right? And this is the way that the bacteria is responding to time signals of temperature, okay? So this is quite nice. And this really hinges on the ability to measure the output, the behavior, quantitatively. Okay. I'm just going to really quickly go through this other idea where this impulse response now allows us to think about the thermal memory. So we know that the impulse response is telling us that this system wants to go towards the warm direction if it's at a low temperature. So if we take the system and raise it at a high temperature, it should want to go the other way. That means at high temperature, the impulse response should invert, and it does here. So basically, by looking at single bacteria at two different temperatures, I can show that the impulse response inverts. And this is telling us that there is a thermophilic drive, and at high temperatures, there's a cryophilic drive. So now I can interrogate the thermal memory by looking at different temperatures, studying this response, and looking at the fraction of bacteria that have a thermophilic response versus a cryophilic response. And this inverts at about 37 degrees. So this allows us to measure the thermal memory of the system. Okay? All right. So we also did some microfluidics to make this measurement. And I just want to make an abrupt segue into a more complicated system. Right? So the whole point of the first section was to say, look, we have a beautiful system. The parts are well understood. We have a one-dimensional time series as a behavioral output. Now we want to take that and see if we can apply a similar idea to a more complicated organism. And the more complicated organism is C. elegans. It's more complicated, but simple. So this is why it's nice. It has neurons. Only 300 neurons, approximately. The connectivity of these neurons is well understood. People have done serial EM reconstructions, and the neuron-to-neuron connection are known. What's not known is the directionality of the signaling. So we don't know if this neuron inhibits or activates, but we know that they're connected, right? There's a multitude of tools to study, to perturb the system. I won't go into now, but it's a very flexible organism, right? So what we want to do is we want to take this organism and try to study the neuronal networks with the same strategy as has been successful for bacteria. So basically, we want systems that we can modify the sensory inputs and actually quantify the motor outputs, right? Okay, so I'm going to argue that this is challenging for the worm. So how does one describe the behavior of C. elegans? Well, the worm behavior is more higher dimensional than the bacteria. So for bacteria, you just observe a single motor. But for the worm, when it moves, it does all sorts of movements. It does a sinusoidal movement to move forward, but it also moves backwards, it turns, it bends. And people have tried to characterize this motion, and they do it by looking at sort of these stereotyped cartoon behaviors of the worm. In fact, people actually publish papers like this, where they just simply describe, literally in cartoons, in this case, what happens when the worm bumps its head into a bead. And we know we can do better than that, right? So for today, what I wanted to do is I wanted to discuss sort of the zero-order systems-level study of this motion of bacteria, of worms, right? And the idea underlying this is that the worm, even when not presented with any sensory information, still has a stochastic but sort of a rational strategy of foraging, okay? So the idea is if the worm is not presented with any information, it doesn't just sit there, it will actively seek out information. So it has a foraging pattern that is stochastic but can be well measured in some of the instrumentation that we developed. So basically what happens is that it will explore its environment randomly, but say if the worm is moving in a two-state system where it can move forward and reorient, the statistics of the dwell time in the forward movement changes, it adapts, dependent on how hungry the worm is. So my point is that the worm has evolved a stochastic strategy to try to find resources of information. And it depends on randomly sort of reorienting in time. These distributions can be well measured. I'm interested in understanding how the biology generates these distributions and how it changes them. All right, so I'll try to be I'll be more concrete in the next slide, so hopefully this will make more sense. So look, if I take a worm and I put it on an auger plate, we can track the movement of this worm. So this worm moves around, we can follow its motions. This some statistics we can measure on this motion, right? So if you think of optimal foraging theory for Brownian walks, or for some type of walk that has a forward state and a reorientation state, people may argue that the distribution of the forward states should not be Brownian or exponential. They should be more fat with at the tail, or they might be power law. And that's because if I'm trying to find something, right, a random target, and locally I do not find this target, if I'm doing a Brownian search, it'll take me a long time to diffuse away from this area that has no information. So I need to increase my probability of making these long excursions, or I'll get caught in these sort of empty local searches. Right? So the worm basically does something like this. What it does is it has this forward and backwards sort of movement. And separating these two movements might be things like an omega turn or a bend. And so one can actually look at the statistics of this sort of strategy and show that the statistics change from, say, a Brownian strategy to a Levy strategy or a power law strategy or a distribution with a fatter tail. Okay. So let me try to show you some of these measurements. So basically, if I take a worm and I quantify the motions, I can see that there's these reversal behaviors. Right? If I now focus on all the behavior that reorients the worm, say a reversal, and I look at the duration of the time before I made that reversal, I can produce these distributions. Okay. So here what the worm is doing is that I'm looking at the worm behavior over time, say 30 minutes, and I'm looking at the probability distribution of being in the forward movement state as a function of early, middle, and late times. So in early times, what happens is that the distribution has a tau that is short. Okay. But now what happens is that the worm is getting hungry. So it knows that it has to make longer excursions because locally it cannot find some food. So what it does, it will extend the tau, increase the tau, and have a distribution with longer forward states. Question? It is exponential. No, in this case it's not fat tail. In this case we're looking at only the forward distribution. All I'm showing here is that this is not strictly exponential, actually. All right. I'm not going to argue if it's a power law or a Levy walk. I'm just going to argue that there's a fixed distribution, and this distribution changes over time. If you look carefully, you'll see that there are some fat tails, actually. Okay, I mean, it's hard to see here, and it's a log plot. So. Okay, so we want to ask this question. How does a system generate these statistics? And I'm going to argue that they're not necessarily, I mean, it's not necessarily trivial to understand how the system will generate these probability distributions when you try to incorporate, say, a bunch of neurons, right, and try to build up a model where you have 50 components. But at this level, we want to coarse grain, right, the model of how this system might be generating these distributions. All right, so it's going to take a little work, but hopefully we'll get there in the next 10, 20 minutes. Okay. So basically, the pursuit is trying to understand how the system generates these distributions. So the first thing we wanted to do is we wanted to sort of parameterize the output of this motion in an objective and comprehensive way. All right. So most people will just observe this, and maybe they'll just look at the center of mass motions. But what we wanted to do is we wanted to utilize the information that the worm is showing in changing of its shape, of its curvature, right? So this is the first thing we did. We took the worm. It moves because the curve moves, right? So we parameterized the curve as a set of angles between some discretized set of points along the curve, right? So now I can look at this curve in time by just looking at the angle of this curve and seeing how those angles change in time. So we don't need, say, 100 angles to describe any worm shape, because there's correlations in the physics of the worm bending and likely how it's controlled. So the dimensionality of the description is much smaller than 100 dimensions. So what we did was we looked at principal component analysis of the data, which is all the free behaving curves that the worm undergoes when it freely behaves. So we can now reconstruct the variation in those curves with only about 3 or 4 fundamental nodes, fundamental vectors, right? And we call this the eigenworm space of the shapes. And we get these fundamental modes of description. So these are the sort of first 4 eigenvectors or eigenmodes in theta space, and this is in real shape space. So these first 2 vectors are sort of sine and cosine, and there's a bending mode and a sort of higher order wriggle mode, right? Believe it or not, these are actually extremely useful, okay? So I'm going to try to show you how useful they are. So basically, we take these modes now, and we take the curve of the worm as it behaves, and we simply find the amplitudes of the modes, okay? So this is just a linear system of modes 1, 2, and 3. We can reconstruct this curve by now just looking at the amplitudes. There's some structure in this. If I look at this worm crawling and calculate the modes 1, 2, and 3, and just sort of look at the phase space and the trajectories in this phase space as it crawls, you'll see that there's sort of this limit cycle as I project that down to modes 1 and 2. And when the worm bends, there's this excursion in mode 3. So for this talk, I'm just going to talk about the first 2 modes, all right? We're going to use these to capture the behavior of the worm. So this looks sort of suspiciously like a dynamical system, and the idea might be that we can learn the equations of motion of the deterministic components of the worm by looking at the phase space, all right? That's the idea, okay? See, there's structure here, right? So now we have the system. I'm going to argue that if we look at modes 1 and 2, this sort of looks like a phase oscillator. The worm crawls and undulates, sort of like a snake. There's a cyclic mode to this movement. If I plot the first 2 modes, what happens is that as the system goes through its oscillatory cycle, you can see the movement in this limit cycle in A1 and A2. So now what we can do is we can just take the derivative of this phase, we could calculate an angular velocity. And the sine velocity is going to tell us if it's going in the forward direction or in the backwards direction. Right? So this gives us a neat handle to quantify, say, the velocity and position of the worm. Okay. This is a correlation of the actual center of mass velocity of the worm with the angular velocity, and it's highly correlated. Right? So now what we do is basically what I just said. We have this position. This position correlates to where the worm is in its oscillatory cycle. The derivative gives the angular velocity. It goes up and goes down, and we can measure this. Right? Just a note, why we use the eigenmodes is because when you have an elongated animal like this and it sort of bends and moves around, the center of mass of the system actually is quite noisy, right? But we have much reduced noise when we're looking at these two eigenmodes, right? Okay. So I'm going to argue that there's a deterministic component in this, because if you look at the movements of this forward and backwards transition, the worm's moving forward, it's moving backward, it doesn't do it arbitrarily. There's stereotype movements in the phase space. So if I calculate the position and the velocity using these eigenmodes, most of the time what happens is the worm is moving in a positive direction. And occasionally it's moving in a negative direction. This is angular velocity, right? But when it makes a transition, what happens, it does it in a phase-specific manner. It doesn't just arbitrarily move backwards. There's some confinement in how it makes this transition, okay? So what we're going to look now for is we're going to look for equations of motion that capture this deterministic component of this behavior. So what we have is something that looks like this, right? We're going to calculate phi and derivative of phi, angular velocity, and we should also be able to calculate the acceleration, the change in velocity. And I'm going to argue that there's a deterministic component here, which is sort of like a force, and there's a noise term, because this is biology. Okay? So how do we do this? Well, we have the data. So we have basically the acceleration or the force as a function of phi and angular velocity. And we get this because we just have tons of movies of the worm just moving around, crawling around freely. At each point in time, around that moment, we can calculate a phi, a position. We can calculate how fast it's moving. And then a little farther, we can calculate the acceleration. We have the data. And this is the mean acceleration as a function of phi and omega. We can fit some functional form to this, capture this, right? We fit this. And then we take that functional form and we subtract from the real data. And now we look at the variation, the variance around that, and that's the noise. So we can calculate the noise term. What's that? That component of noise is just going to be fluctuations of F, right? As you look at the whole population of worms. It's not a tumble component. It's actually literally what's left after you subtract off F. Okay? All right. Yep.
Over how many cycles do you calculate the
omega? How many time points? We don't have to calculate over cycles. We only calculate, we need to calculate just phi dot,
okay,
which could be wavelength, right? Yeah. Okay. So this is nice. Basically, this allows us to say, well, we have this dynamical system, we have equations of motion. Is this informative? So basically, here I have F from the previous slide. We have this noise term. Is it really noise? There's a priori, I don't think, a well sort of accepted test, right? But we can do things like, well, if you look at the noise term and compare it to another time scale, say, the correlation of how velocity changes in time, if we look at the noise term, you see that the noise term correlation is very short. It's noise-like, okay? But I think what's even more sort of successful here is the fact that if we look at the F term, if we look at the forcing term, we should be able to use that to evolve the system. Basically, I can say I'm going to pick a point here, and this equation tells me how this evolves, how the trajectory should evolve in this phase space. So we do that. We start with a bunch of initial conditions and we find some limit cycles. This is the forward movement state. This is the reverse movement state. And we find some stable points. These are pause states. And you might argue that, okay, this is not very exciting, because I can just look at the worm and tell that it's moving forward, moving backwards, and pausing, right? But what we've done here is we didn't make any assumptions. Only the data, right, told us about these sort of stable states. And this is one definition of behavior, okay? So now what we want to do is we want to take this formalism, and we want to see now if we can understand how the system switches states, okay? Because in this case, right, what we have is no noise. I'm just looking at the F component. So once this thing falls into one of these stable states, this limit cycle, this stable point, it's not going to leave. But we know it does leave. And the idea is that it leaves, it transitions between these states, because we know that there's a noise term. And so it might be in this limit cycle, but there's noise here. And this noise, depending on how large this noise is, it can kick this out and go into another trajectory, into another behavior. Can this work at some level? Can this capture some of the real behavior of the worm? Right. So this is the attempt. So the idea is we have these equations of motion. And the analogy is like a ball in subpotential. So this ball can leave the potential to another stable state because it has some noise. Okay? If I want to increase, I want to modify, we know that the worm can modify how it transitions out of the state into another state. It can do two things. It can increase the noise, right? Or it can change the potential. Right? So we're going to ask, what does the worm do when it changes its distribution of being in this forward state before a reversal? We know that distribution changes. It has a short, it has a tau that's small and increases. It becomes more stable at some level. What does the worm do? Okay. Yep.
So how do you relate the sign of being in forward state to the variable on the moment?
Yeah. So how do we actually measure it, or how do we calculate it? So what we can measure it?
What do you define as forward state, and how is it related to these two
variables? Yeah. Okay. Well, the forward state is this an omega that's positive over some threshold, very small threshold. It has to be positive over some very small threshold. And we can look at the duration of this. You got it? Okay. All right. So now what we want to do is we want to see, okay, if we can, using the noise we measure, the amplitude of the noise, and this deterministic structure of F, can we now sort of simulate with a stochastic model, calculate by making many, many simulations on this deterministic landscape with the measured noise, the survival time in the forward state. So I just put myself in the forward state. I have some noise. I do this over and over again. I can calculate the expected time in the forward state. I can also measure this. So I've measured this. I showed you that for a specific epoch, is it early, middle, or late times, I can calculate this seemingly exponential distribution, this some tau here, 16 seconds. I can simulate this using the stochastic model. I can also get a time which is very close to this, real time, about 16 seconds. Right? So this is amazing, if you think about it, because when I actually develop the model, I'm only looking locally in time. I'm looking at time t, I'm looking at my position, I'm looking at my velocity, I'm looking at my acceleration. And then I move a little small t and I do this, and I generate this landscape. But then I want to predict a behavior that is many, many length scales or time scales away from the time scale I used to make this model. So we sample at 32 hertz. We're calculating this at 1 over 32 per second. This generates a time scale of 16 seconds, okay, which really matches well with this real data. This part is a little confusing. Basically, we want to see how this this lifetime scales with scaling how noisy the system is. So if this really is acting like a ball in a potential, activated by thermal transition, we know that the temperature dependence should be exponential, should be Arrhenius. So here we scale the effective energy that's producing the noise that we see in the real world data. And at least for small noise, okay, what happens is that this system behaves exponentially. All right? I wouldn't read too much into that, but it does seem like it is acting sort of like a ball thermally activated to go over some barrier. All right. Okay, so basically we want to now ask this question. We believe it's acting like a ball that's thermally activated to go over some barrier. If I want to change the lifetime of the ball in this potential, I can do two things. I can change the potential, I can change the noise. So we do this measurement. We take the worm and we look at early, middle, and late times. And we know that at early times, the tau to be in the fourth state is shorter than in the long time. So something has to change. So here we calculate basically the force of the trajectory where I take all the reversal events, I'm going backwards, and then I look at the history of the worm right before it goes into reversal. I calculate the average force trajectory, and I get this. I also calculate the noise, and I get this. So you can see in this case, what the worm does, it doesn't change a deterministic component. It just changes the amount of noise that's in the system to change this effective tau of being in the forward state. All right? So, okay, maybe this is an economical way for the worm to generate these statistics, this stochastic behavior. We wanted to now explore a possibility of, can we see perturbations in the forcing function as well, right? So to do that, we studied the behavior of a specific mutant. And this mutant, GOA1, has a mutation in its alpha subunit of G protein signaling. And for people to understand this, this is very ubiquitous signaling, right? It's in basically every cell, every neuron. It's defective, okay? So if we perturb the system so it has a defect in almost all neurons, we can see what happens is that the deterministic part of the system actually is affected, this forcing function is affected, and the noise in the system is affected. I forgot to tell you why we picked this mutant. We picked this mutant because it's hyper-reversing. Its forward state dwell time is shorter compared to the wild-type behavior. And so we also get effective shortening in the stochastic simulation calculation. But more importantly here, we show that both of these components can change. Okay? All right. So basically what we're saying here is that if you sort of coarse-grain this behavior, this might be an interesting way to tame the complexity of looking at neuronal networks. There's these modules that people have identified that are important in different behaviors. People are trying to build up deterministic models of how this behavior works by looking at networks. But maybe some of these networks are actually trying to do very simple things. And in this case, understanding this forward dwell time, what might be happening is these neurons that are controlling this behavior, all they do is effectively are forming this deterministic landscape. And somehow the worm, on top of this landscape, right, that's imposed by the complexity of the neuronal network and the biochemical networks happening in the neurons, it has somehow evolved a way to just tweak the noise. And by tweaking this noise, it has an ability to change the long-term behavior in this state. Okay? So at this point, I think this is a really nice sort of organizing way of dealing with some of this complexity. And so in the worm, what's nice about the worm is that there are actually quite nice ways to try to investigate how the noise in the system manifests. Because in the worm system, we can actually measure the behavior of the worm while looking at neuronal signals of these purported neurons, okay, in this network. And look to see if there's correlations of noise at the neuronal, at the physiological level, with the behavioral events that we see or we measure at this time without looking at the signals. Okay? All right. So I think that's all I wanted to say. We do a lot more in the lab. We're interested sort of a theoretical way of how these worms are foraging and investigating the environment without information. We're interested in how this thing moves. We're interested in how this responds to temperature, I have talked about today. We're attempting to track at a systems level many neurons of the worm while it freely behaves, while measuring the neural signals. So we have tracking FRET microscopy. And we're also doing quantitative genomics to try to look at high-dimensional data sets of behavior and how it's correlated with various perturbations in the genome. And these are the people that did the work that I mainly talked about today. Okay, thanks. Yeah, I mean, I guess I don't think I would explicitly try to calculate energetically what's happening, right, in the control system, right? But I think people do find that there is sort of a bandwidth problem in control. Everything from like when you grasp or something, you have this huge phase space of movements, but how you actually make these decisions, the amount of information that needs to be transferred is quite small. And that leads to stereotype movements, right? The worm's the same, right? So the idea might be if I wanted to generate a stochastic strategy with some simple flexibility, right? What is the most simple way that this thing can do it? This might be, right, the simplest way. The landscape, so the argument here is like the landscape is not very flexible. The landscape, when I say the landscape, I mean sort of the forcing function that is what it is, right? That's the deterministic part. If I'm up on the hill, I'm going to go down the hill. That component is dictated by the connectivity, the neurons and how they're connected in the worm. It's not easy to all of a sudden adjust that connectivity. So you're playing with some slow-moving, on an evolutionary sense, deterministic component. So on top of that, if you wanted to adjust and adapt, what one might be able to do is change the noise. That might be easier. And that might be literally just by allowing some neuron to fluctuate, right, in signal. How unique? It's not necessary. How unique? So basically, we want to fit the function as best as we can and not overfit. So it's not very unique functionally, right? Because we don't have any a priori sort of foundation of saying it has to be this function. So basically, we're only trying to be predictive. Yes. I mean, if sigma is constant and there's some underlying F, we still fit F. It doesn't depend on sigma. Yeah.
When you see the computational neuroscience, it seems like often you see these neuron networks. And
yeah.
And they sort of isolate one component and they're trying to fit.
Yeah.
And the overall thing always seems to me like, you know, great complexity. Then, you know, I mean, so in a sense, you know, there has to be some overarching simple I mean, say mathematically, we talk about mathematical elegance, but say from a physical point of view, you know, you're always looking at, I guess the equivalent thing would be something like Occam's razor, and you want an explanation, some sort of principle that guides this complex network other than just fitting.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of a circular argument, though. Mm-hmm. Like, at some level, I selected something that has a sort of simple output.
Right.
I'm just looking at something that goes forward and back.
Yeah.
And there's some statistics to this,
right.
And it's so it has to, the output has to be simple. I mean, the system has to be simple at some level, right?
Because otherwise, it seems like a losing battle to me. You know, if you're always looking at single components within a complex network, you don't have some sort of overarching, simpler principle,
right? So, but at the same time, it's not just one neuron.
Yes.
It's multiple neurons and multiple connectivity.
Any other questions? Back to the device that we have and then a
When the transitions happen? In the forcing function, we could probably calculate, you know, by looking at the curvature, the derivative, where there's some separation between sort of these stable states. But I haven't looked at that. I don't know where those transitions are. On the other end, when we describe the behavior, we just arbitrarily say that the transitions happened, you know, between this point and this point. Why we do that is because, you know, it's subjective. The behavior is subjective. Now, what's nice about the reversing is that it's a very clear transition point because it's moving forward and now it's moving backwards, right? And so the transition is when it goes to zero speed, say, okay? But in the landscape, we don't know, and we could figure it out, but I couldn't tell exactly where the boundary is, if that's the question. I mean, They're not very, very close. Because if you look at some of the trajectories, they're extended, right? Trajectories that get to the stable point, they're extended. We'll only look at two dimensions here, right? And we know actually in the shape space there are multiple dimensions. So there could be sort of trajectories that are not in the first two mode space that are important.
And, you know, one of the problems I always have when you study these